local talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. And hello to you, the listener. I am your host today, Jim Werbel. And today's show, as well as a part of next week's show, focuses on missionary work, actually. I know that's an unusual topic, especially for someone of Jewish background. It all started when we were having a production meeting, and I saw some Mormon missionaries walking past the studio. To make a long story short, they did not agree to be on the show, but I contacted Mike Easton from Cornerstone Church, who is in charge of their outreach work. I promised some surprises in the interview. We also have Alex Pfeffer back to talk about Billy Sunday. Finally, Mary Rankin returns again. This time she's wearing her hat as the director of ISU's Live Green Initiative. She'll be talking about LEED building certification with Carrie Dixon from ISU. So welcome to the show. To start the show, I'd like to welcome Alex back to KHOI, who will explain some, always explain some interesting historical facts about Ames. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, it's always interesting, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you, why is it that it's called Billy Sunday Road? You know, it's that road to the ball diamonds. Is it has something to do with there's so many ball games on Sunday or something like that?
No, but it does have an interesting baseball connection I'll talk about later. But Billy Sunday Road, it's only been named Billy Sunday Road since 1991, I'm sorry, when it was renamed by the Ames Heritage Association, which we were called at that point, did an initiative through the city and got that renamed because that road actually leads to the Corey Family Cemetery, which is where Billy Sunday's birthplace was, where he grew up. And so he was born in 1862, 2 years before Ames was even a town officially.
Interesting.
He predates everything. So if anyone's ever been to that dog park out on Billy Sunday Road, kind of by the apartments there by Wilson Toyota, there is a tiny little fenced off cemetery, and that's where Billy Sunday's mother, his brother, and some other family members are buried out there all the way back to the 1860s.
Well, tell us a little bit about Billy Sunday.
Yeah, he was born in 1862. His father was in the Civil War, died 4 months before he was born, so Billy's mother remarried a few times, and they kind of had a little bit of a rough go. So Billy was then taken to the Iowa Soldiers Orphanage Home in Glenwood and later Davenport. He eventually did return to Ames when he was 14, living with his grandparents, but they didn't get along too well, and so he moved to Nevada, attended Nevada High School, worked as a janitor, and did things to earn room and board, and got on the baseball team there in Nevada. And so in the 1880s, he moved to Marshalltown, and because of his speed, he got a job on the fire brigade team and also worked at a furniture shop and the town baseball team.
What position did he play in baseball?
He was an outfielder. He was, in fact, discovered by Cap Anson. Maybe some of you have heard of him, famous baseball Hall of Famer. Well, Cap had an aunt who lived in Marshalltown and just started bragging about how fast this Billy Sunday kid was. And so Anson came under the recommendation of A.G. Spaulding, another famous baseball name there, who was president of the Chicago White Stockings, later to be renamed the Chicago Cubs, and he signed Billy to a contract. And so his speed was his greatest asset. In fact, they even arranged a race between Billy Sunday and Arlie Latham, the fastest runner in the American Association, and they said Billy won by 100 yards in that contest.
Okay, so he was a speedster. Was he a hitter too, or did he have his batting average by any chance?
No, I don't have that honor. He wasn't a very good hitter. His most thing, he was a very exciting but inconsistent outfielder. So he played in the days before gloves.
Oh. And
so he was out there making thrilling catches, long sprints, athletic dives, and many errors.
Okay, that'd be different. He had something different phase of his life, too, as well as baseball.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, baseball, even though baseball is always a part of his life, he would go to games and umpire when he was doing his circuit and everything. And he even went to the 1935 World Series 2 months before he died. But through baseball, Billy found religion. While he was playing for the Chicago team, a lot of his teammates would, back then baseball players were heavy drinkers and they'd go out and have a lot of fun, some gambling, that
kind of thing.
They still do that.
Pete Rose.
Yeah, exactly. And so Billy said Ballplayers would all go to saloons, and while they drank highballs and gin fizzes and beers, he would take lemonade. And so Billy was never quite the drinker, and so when his buddies would go out and have a good time, he would just go wander around Chicago. And he found the Pacific Garden Mission in Chicago, and he was walking by and heard them singing some hymns that his mother used to sing. So he went in and started to kind of sit down and take it all in.
Huh.
But so Billy, at that point, then he decided to turn down a $500 a month contract for the Cincinnati National League Club and accepted an $85 a month job for the Chicago YMCA. So he kind of really took a pay cut to do what he really wanted.
Yeah. Big pay cut. He found religion.
Yeah, exactly. And so his first platform appearance was in Gardner, Iowa in 1861. And that's where he became aware of his direct, sincere manner of speaking that really got through to people. And so over the next 12 years, he would preach in approximately 70 communities, mostly in Iowa and Illinois. And he referred to it as the kerosene circuit, because unlike Chicago, most of these towns were not electrified yet. They were still using kerosene lamps.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So he took advantage of his status as a baseball player to get in. Do things like in 1907 in Fairfield, Iowa, he organized two local businesses into baseball teams, scheduled a game. He even came in his uniform and played on both sides and then gave a tent revival show afterwards. So he was always kind of never left that baseball. It always kind of stayed a little bit inside of him.
This was before radio and TV, so he really just had the tent circuits at that
time. Yeah, exactly. And even the point where he would be, he helped set a lot of them up. They would build and even fund some of them that they would do in town until I think, unfortunately, one time in Colorado, they built their big tabernacle and a storm knocked it down and they got stiffed with the bill basically for
all
it
because
the show couldn't go on. And so after that, they decided the town should build the tabernacles. And so there are still a few of those structures left around the Midwest.
Interesting. So what happened at the end of his career?
Well,
Alex?
Billy, he died in 1935 at the age of 73. Ending a very remarkable career, supposedly preaching to over 100 million people in tents. And he is now buried in Chicago. So Billy is not out at the Corey Family Cemetery, unfortunately. He's buried in Chicago, but his family is still out there. One thing I'd like to share about Billy, he was really great for having quotes.
Okay.
So I'm going to share a few of these.
Please do.
There's one. The church gives the people what they need. The theater gives them what they want. Nearly everybody is stuck up about something. Some people are even proud that they aren't proud. This one I think is my absolute favorite of his, though. Going to church doesn't make a man a Christian any more than going to a garage makes him an automobile.
He had some wisdom to himself.
Yeah, he was very definitely on participation. He didn't think people just had to just go to church and that was it. Like, here's one he's got. The carpet in front of your mirror of some of you people is worn threadbare, while at the side of your bed where you should kneel and pray, it's as good as the day you put it down.
I can see why he had between his baseball and his speaking ability, he seemed to find a natural talent in the tent circuit.
Mm-hmm. And they'd say he would slide across the stage almost like he was sliding into home plate. He's the type, he would jump up onto the podium and, you know, kind of shake his fist a little bit and really get riled people's attention.
Interesting. Well, thank you, Alex, for sharing information about Billy and Billy's Sunday Road and his birthplace.
Yeah, no problem. Yep, right here in Ames.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Alex.
Thank you so much.
Well, related to this is our next guest, who is Mike Easton, who is the regional and global ministry leader at Cornerstone Church. He'll be talking about missionary work in Ames at Cornerstone Church.
I'd like to welcome Mike Easton to the show, who is the regional and global ministry leader at Cornerstone Church. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jim.
That's quite a title. Can you tell me what that title means?
Basically, the regional and global ministry leader at Cornerstone, I'm in charge of everything that we do locally in Ames to be able to reach out to people, and specifically with the poverty impacted and the needy within our community. But then globally, we're also thinking about how can we meet the needs of those who are in poverty around the world, and how can we help plant churches in different areas in the world as well.
I guess some people would call this missionary work. Do you call it missionary work or something else?
Yeah, sometimes we would call it missionary work. I mean, sometimes there's connotations with that of proselytization or forcing people to come to faith. And I would say that the way that we would go about some different things would certainly be to proclaim the good news of the gospel that we believe, but also to do it in very tangible ways with people that will help meet their needs too.
Give me an example of a program that you do here in Ames in your community outreach activities.
Yeah, so one of the programs that we do is called the Home for a While program. And this program helps with transitional living for families who've just kind of been a little bit down and out. Maybe they lost their job or having some difficulty in their life. And as you know, in Ames, there's a kind of a housing crunch these days because there's so many students, which is a great problem to have because it means Iowa State University is doing great. But for those who are poverty impacted, poor, marginalized within our community, it's very expensive to have housing here in Ames. In fact, the average apartment is about $750 a month. And so somebody who's on a minimum wage job, you'd have to work 2.5 of those jobs to be able to afford housing here in Ames. And so our program basically is a 3-month program and a year long program where we are helping people to transition from maybe they have overdue rent, credit, medical bills, things like that, helping them to get back up on their feet. And we do mentoring through that process, through finances, through anger management, through different sorts of things that help people as they come out of poverty.
So let's say I call you and I say, I don't have any place to stay. What are you going to do for me?
So that is a challenge, and that happens to us very often, that we do get lots of calls.
I assume some people have that kind of an attitude as well.
Yeah, sometimes certainly people will have an attitude of what can you do for me? And honestly, I think as the church, we should try to do our best to provide an answer to some of those questions. And the reality is we don't always have great answers to that, and we want to do a better job of that. Some of the best things that we can do is there are 2-week housing options for people with the emergency residence shelter on Kellogg Avenue. But if we have openings within our place, we will say, hey, there's a 3-month opening and we ask you to do some of the mentoring things that we do, but we'll provide some cheaper rent for you and an opportunity for you to get back on your feet. And for some folks, we'll even provide a year-long lease that's a little bit cheaper rent for people, but gives them that transitional period for them. And oftentimes we do have to say, we just don't have a spot for you, and that's all that we can do. Every once in a while, we'll also try to, especially with young people, help them find homes, places to stay within one of the members of our church, their home if they have extra space too.
As many people know, people in transitional living often have a host of other issues mm-hmm. that they're dealing with. What do you do to help people deal with those transitions? Because I think your goal is to get them to be independent.
Yeah, absolutely. We can provide the housing for people, but we know that that's just a band-aid fix to people. What we really want to be able to do is to help them walk through some of the burdens that they have in their life, whether that's a financial burden that they have in their life, whether that's an emotional burden that they'd have, physical burden sometimes as well, and then a spiritual burden for sure. We would want to help people be able to walk through all those different things. So we'll do things with our mentoring, through finance mentoring, through, like I said before, anger and emotional management, to help people walk through some of that. So we have community groups that meet a couple times a month to help those people do those things together. And we hope that it's not simply a paternalistic mentoring sort of thing, but we do it in community so that, because we know that everyone in that room is a human being. They have dignity, they have value, and they have something to bring to the table. And even if we have a program or more materials, we know that there's a lot of things that those people bring together and how they can help one another.
Could you give me an example of someone whose life you've helped and what they've done with themselves?
One of the specific people that we've helped out is a gal who was living in Des Moines. She came up to Ames and was working at Walmart. She was staying with some friends for a little while. It was kind of back and forth between Des Moines and Ames. And we were able to help provide an apartment for her that helped her to pay off some of her old bills. We were also able to provide some mentors who helped her to work through some of her financial difficulties in life, and also some of her emotional and spiritual challenges that she had in her life. And now she's able to afford her own apartment and is involved in a local church here in Ames that's not Cornerstone, but involved in another church.
Did you help her child as well?
Yeah, we would help her child as well. I mean, I think through the program as a whole, we would certainly look to help the parents for the most part, because we believe the family is the best place to be able to do that. But through providing some friends for this young man and through the mentoring program, I think we were able to help the son as well in that situation.
You keep mentioning a mentoring program. I'd like to hear a little bit more about what your mentoring program does.
Yeah, so with our mentoring program, we have a few folks within our church that have decided that this would be a great opportunity for them to make an impact on the community. They see the need that's happening. And so these mentors will try to meet once a week with the different families. And whether it's having them over to their home, going to their home, taking them out to eat, going and doing some of the errands that they would have, basically just being friends to them, being a relationship to them, in some ways serving some of the needs that a parent would serve to these people as well, or a grandparent. Parent, that sort of thing. But basically, having a relationship with them would be the most important part. It's very easy when we think about helping people to become paternalistic to them and say, hey, come take these classes. Come. We would rather have people to have a relationship with them.
Give me another example of a local program that you're engaged with.
Yeah, another program that we're engaged with is the mentoring program, both through YSS and one that we've helped to start at Kate Mitchell School and at Edwards School as well. We have the privilege at Cornerstone of having about 1,500 college students that regularly come through our doors. And these college students, this generation really is very interested in social justice issues. And they're wanting to get their hands dirty. They're wanting to be a part of what's happening. They're wanting to really help people in very tangible ways. We have a mentoring program that our students from the SALT Company, which is the college ministry of Cornerstone Church, are involved with. And there's about 200 of them that go to either Kate Mitchell School or Edwards School or Meeker Elementary School. And they meet once a week with a student and mentor them. And through this program, we've been able to see, I think the overall feel of those schools even change, with the kids who would be considered at risk now having someone in their life that they can have that is guaranteed will come once a week to be able to spend some time with them. And they'll do anything from read to them in class to eat lunch with them or to play with them at recess. And just that another positive figure in their life, while they can't replace a parent by any means, really helps them to be able to form better attachments in their life and make better choices throughout the course of their life too.
It seems like you do a lot of mentoring. That seems to be the primary emphasis that you're working on in your ministry is relationship ministry. Do you want to explain that, your philosophy behind that more?
Yeah, the reason that we focus on mentoring is that we believe that relationships are really one of the best way to be able to impact people. More and more studies are finding that aid or just giving away money without some level of relationship in that sort of thing actually can be more harmful than helpful to people. And while we don't want to be stingy, we really do want to be generous with people. We've found that that's not always the answer. Mentoring is an important part for us of being able to help them gain some skills in their life to be able to communicate the message that we love to communicate as well, and just to fill a felt need that all of us have, because all of us are in need of relationship. And so the mentoring relationship, while sometimes paternalistic, hopefully it won't be very often. It'll be more of a friendship relationship that meets that real need we all have.
What kind of training do you give your mentors? You see your head nodding. That's an important question.
It is a very important question, and I think this is an area that we need to grow in, honestly. We're looking to provide some classes for our people. We've started to do a few seminars to help them think through this, but we're an upper-middle-class church, and so many of us honestly don't interact very often with those who are poverty-impacted and marginalized in our community. It's actually pretty easy to ignore that in our community if you don't really look for it, and that's unfortunate. That's a reality of where we are as a church. However, I think we're taking great strides in that, and our people are starting to understand the need for that. However, we've not grown up with those mindsets. We've grown up with a very different mindset. Most of the folks in our church do come from a fairly healthy family background, a fairly affluent, or at least middle class sort of background, where the way that we think is often almost like a different culture from those who are poverty impacted. And so we train our folks to think about how to do cross-cultural servanthood to people. How do we serve the people who are almost in a different culture than us because they've grown up with a very different mindset? They've had different groups of people that they've hung out with, and their thoughts on money, on relationships, on entertainment, it's all different.
So you work with these people. I know with mentors, you're probably individual variations, but what are the expectations for them to come to Cornerstone Church?
there would be no expectation for these folks to be able to come to Cornerstone Church. We would certainly hope that that would be something that they would choose to do, or whether to be involved in another church in an area. That would be a hope that we have. We also want to be able to provide needs for people without any strings attached. And while it's a great hope for us to have people come, there would not be strings attached to that.
That's a delicate balance. How do you manage that delicate balance without making people feel that they're pressured to convert?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is an incredibly delicate balance. One, we just don't require that for anybody, but also we are available to listen and to ask questions. And a lot of times we'll maybe wait to talk about our faith till some questions are asked. But we would hope that those questions would be asked. At the same time, as it's an important message for all of us to be sharing and to be talking about with other people. And so there will be opportunities that we have to be able to share. We also will work within what are the rules of the places that we're working in. So within the school systems, we're obviously very careful about that sort of thing. And we only would ever do something if a child was to ask us about our faith in that situation. But yeah, it's a very delicate balance, but I think that both Christians and non-Christians alike we've been able to work with them to be able to understand what are the right things to say and what are the wrong things to say, and how do we both stand up for what we believe in, proclaim what we believe in, but then also be respectful to others and talk about it at the right timing and the right needs and not ever have any strings attached to the things that we're doing for people.
What's your motivation, both personal, philosophical motivations for doing the type of activities, the community outreach activities that you're doing?
I think the motivation for me personally is the message that I believe. I do believe that the good news of Jesus Christ is available for all people. And it is a response in my life to what he has done by being God and becoming a man. For me also to consider, how do I serve other people as well? As God has served me, how do I serve others? And so it's an overflow of my relationship with God to want to help other people, and then also to be able to proclaim the message that I have. So my motivation is completely with my faith.
Explain the service more. I'm curious about that. A lot of Christians just believe, have faith, but they don't feel the need to serve.
I think in recent years, I've started to understand that a little bit better. Jesus said that the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And so as Christians or as followers of Christ, I think that's a really important thing that we would do in our life. If we're not the ones who are helping serve the communities and different things along those lines, I think we're really missing an important component of who we are as Christians and following our Savior.
It is true. You think about the people, the stories in the Bible about the people that Jesus did serve, and they really weren't those with a lot of money.
Yeah, it is very true that Jesus spent most of his time with people who the people of that society would have considered sinners, so to speak, but also people who didn't necessarily have a lot of money, a lot of things that most people would consider or something that they'd bring to the table. They were often the down and out, the marginalized in the society, the least, the lepers, and what many would call the least of these. And so Jesus didn't ignore those people. He actually gravitated towards those people, which I don't know about you. I don't gravitate towards people like that. And I'm seeing Jesus change my life to gravitate towards those type of people.
How do you work with others? Because obviously you're in an administrative position. How do you work with others to help do more service to the community?
Well, we partner with various organizations in the community, from churches that would be very similar to ours to churches that would be different than ours, to other organizations that wouldn't have any sort of faith-based idea. I think that our goals in wanting to serve people, whatever our belief, can honestly be very similar oftentimes.
You say you work with both faith-based and non-faith-based to represent your ideas about that it's you're really trying to serve. Can you give me some examples of both the faith-based as well as the non-faith-based organizations that you work with?
Yeah, so with non-faith-based organizations, we partner with YSS, with Boys and Girls Club, and some other organizations as well. And those organizations are doing a great job serving the at-risk youth within our community. And we join in with their mentoring programs to provide mentors to those different organizations as well. We also partner with some faith-based organizations like Food at First. We help to provide some folks with that. We also are partnering with Teen Challenge, which is a drug rehabilitation program as well. And all of those programs help us to be able to serve those who are in need in our community.
What do you do to encourage people to participate in social action activities?
Well, we have this ministry in our church that's called Find Your Third Place. And basically, we encourage every member of our church to serve both within the church, the people that would be in their small group. But then recently we started to encourage people to serve in their community. And this has been one of those areas that we've not been strong in as a church. But as we started this program about a year and a half ago, we've seen a lot of interest in our people to be serving the community. And we're starting to grow more and more to have more people involved in the community. And it's often been typical that evangelical Christians aren't very involved in their community. And I think that as we have started to do this program, we've begun to see the influence that we have in the community to grow.
I've been talking to Mike Easton, who's the regional, global and ministry leader for Cornerstone Church in Ames. Do you have any final comments, Mike, to share with the listener?
We're very excited to be involved in our community, and we hope that we'll grow a lot. I hope personally that I will grow in being able to serve people. I think it's always a huge challenge to serve other people, but it's one of the things that we're created to do, and it's one of our best opportunities that we have in life to serve our community of Ames.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
I was talking with Mike Easton, who is the regional and global ministry leader at Cornerstone Church, talking about some of their missionary work, you might call it, or social action that they're doing, particularly to help with the homeless. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Radio 89.1 FM, serving Ames and Story City. I am your host today, Jim Werbel, and my next guest is Mary Rankin. And welcome her back to the show. Mary wears two hats. One is the sustainability coordinator for the City of Ames. The other is the sustainability director for ISU. Well, while related, they are different, aren't they, Mary?
They are different. So much carryover, but yet so much unique qualities of each one.
You're dealing with different administrations.
Yes, and different volunteers and different resources and different opportunities.
So today, you're wearing your ISU hat, and you brought a guest with you. Please introduce her.
I'm really excited to have Carrie Dixon with me today. Carrie, oh my gosh, I think I met you within minutes of coming to Iowa State University and immediately knew she was going to be a fantastic resource, a wonderful person to collaborate, and just a great fantastic individual in which to gain wisdom and perspective and energy and enthusiasm.
She is energetic. I know that. Go ahead. Introduce
All
her.
All right. Well, Carrie, why don't you tell us a little bit about your job at Iowa State University?
Carrie Dixon, by the way.
Great. Thanks, Mary and Jim. I am the coordinator for sustainable design and construction. I am employed at facilities, and that means that I have my hands in every one of our sustainably designed and constructed large capital projects, as well as working on greening up our construction activities as a whole on campus. We have, at any given time, $350 to $400 million worth of planning, design, construction, or completion of work going on on any given day on campus.
You oversee all those, the planning, design?
I wish. No, I'm involved in our lead projects. It means I work with the design team, the individual project managers, as well as the architects, engineers, and contractors in helping meet our goals for LEED certification. LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. It was a kind of a grading system that was developed to be able to evaluate buildings that are very different on a same scale so you can really demonstrate how sustainable they were and the way they were designed, how the way they were built, and how they're intended to operate.
give us some examples that LEED looks at so people understand what it takes to get LEED certification.
LEED deals in five primary areas. Site, they want you to make sure you're looking at putting a building in a site that was previously developed or a parking lot. They don't want buildings built in prime virgin farmland or woodland. They want a lot of connection
to prairie.
Or prairie in our case. They want a lot of connection to community activities. You look at water usage, both usage in the building and how you deal with water on your site. You look at energy consumption. It's something that it doesn't really affect the construction of the building, but that's one of the pieces that carries on after we're done. Buildings consume 75% of the energy in the United States. That's just in the building and day-to-day operation. That's not the we're plugging our stuff in. That's just to keep the doors open and lights on.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is.
When you think about it, right?
That is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks at the materials and resources. It's making sure we're using sustainably determined materials. You want to make sure you're not using, you know, steel that is all made out of virgin iron ore. So you look at recycled content materials. You look at materials that are extracted and manufactured within 500 miles of your building site. And you look at the recycling of both the construction waste and providing recycling in a building. On our campus, we have managed to – we average right now about 92% of all construction waste for our large buildings has been recycled.
Where do you get your recycled materials?
It's amazing. Industry has really turned around how they make things. It used to be for carpet, for example. Carpet is mainly all petroleum product. So you were using – you're making nylon, you're making the backing, you're doing all those things. 100% cost from extraction to putting it down. Now big businesses like Interface have realized they can save money by saying we will take back your old carpet and we will recycle. We'll cut the loop off the top. We take the backing. We reconfigure everything, re-dye it, and put out new product that's almost 100% recycled material.
So some businesses are actually leading the edge of, recycling
really,
and sustainability?
It really is. The businesses have seen that there is – they wouldn't do this just to feel better. They do this because there's money to be made. And if you can recycle materials, bring them in, redo them, put them back out again, it means you're not bringing in virgin material, which has a high cost in it and a high cost of handling. So we're seeing it in carpet. We're seeing it in drywall. We're seeing it in ceiling tile. It's ceiling tile is mainly wood pulp. And so people like Armstrong are taking back ceiling tile as it comes out of buildings. As long as it doesn't have mold or lead paint or other things in it, they'll take it back. They break it back down. They reconfigure it and push it back out as brand new ceiling tile.
To what extent do you think LEED certification has driven some of this change?
A lot of it, because LEED is asking the designers and the constructors to document these things. It's kind of like a nutrition label on a side of a box of cereal. So you compare a box of cereal to a loaf of bread to a Snickers bar. They're three very disparate things, but you can compare the amount of protein or carbohydrates or salt. Mm-hmm. And LEED does the same thing.
Okay.
LEED also works with the one of the things that is left when we're done with the building, which is the indoor environment. LEED really pushes the use of daylighting, of natural ventilation, of allowing people to see outside. Studies have shown in K-12 environments that students in a LEED-designed or sustainably designed building, large windows, views to outside, do better than those buildings, the wonderful original sustainably designed buildings that we had that in the 70s we went through and took out all the big wood windows and closed them in and did everything else. Students are showing higher grades, higher retention of material.
Interesting.
Staff is more likely to retain in places. It really, if you are happy to be in an environment, it makes it a lot easier to go to school, to go to work, than to go into a room with absolutely no windows and spend 8 hours a day there.
Mm-hmm. I think there's been some really interesting research industry-wise. Even some companies have piloted half of their building being LEED designed.
Really?
And half not, especially in retail situations. Found sales to be higher on the half of the building that had more daylighting and
LEED
incorporation.
These are big box retailers.
Big box retailers. But, you know, the thing is, as Carrie mentioned, certain things have a cost effectiveness. For companies that are creating these products that go into buildings. But for companies that are choosing to make the lead choice or organizations choosing to make the lead choice, they're really looking at those impacts on their customers and seeing that positive effect. Kind of a triple bottom line effect, Jim.
How about that?
How about that?
Explain the triple bottom line in case people don't know what that
right.
is.
Right. So to be truly sustainable, there's really three facets. We think of the environmental pieces, the impacts on
the
natural
recycling.
Resources, the recycling, the energy conservation, the water usage, that sort of thing. And there's also an economic piece. So how financially sustainable are you being? Are you saving money? Is it costing more? What is the life cycle cost analysis, which is different than first upfront
capital
cost?
Expenditure.
Exactly. But thirdly is this piece of social sustainability, and that's really looking at how are you impacting the personal effect, the community effect. How are you building communities, strengthening societies, creating a healthier environment, creating an environment that's more engaged and more excited about, as Carrie mentioned, going to work, going to school, performing more effectively in those situations. And this is just a perfect example of that triple bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
That we can do in each and every building. We do that on campus. The city has a lot of projects related to LEED as well.
Last time you had the water.
Absolutely.
The new water treatment plant's going to be LEED certified.
Absolutely, right. So it's very interesting in something. And as Carrie mentioned, she doesn't just do larger projects. That's her primary focus. But even classroom-to-classroom renovation, Carrie works with our teams and looks at incorporating more sustainability components as possible. So in something as small as this room, Jim, you've got a triple bottom line effect.
Thank you. Quickly, there's different types of LEED certification. You want to just quickly do that?
Yeah, LEED started out with the classification of new construction and major renovation. So that's really a brand-new building or renovating an entire building. And then they started developing, after being pushed by owners in industry, developed something called core and shell. So that's for the developers. That's the outside of the strip malls, the big boxes. Then you've got commercial interiors, which deals in smaller spaces, as small as 250 square feet to wings of buildings. We do commercial interiors. We have three of those projects on campus right now, which is – those were the first for us, and they're – it's kind of exciting.
So lots of different types of LEED
yep.
certification.
Hospitals, K-12 schools, they're starting to develop something for data centers because data centers are a very unique thing. So there's a lot of different ways to apply it, and it's starting to take off internationally.
And there's also the campus certification.
Yeah, you can
right?
do a campus where you set up some of these credits that apply, like for Iowa State, across our entire campus. We have our policies for water and irrigation. We have our policies for smoking. You know, mm-hmm. no smoking on the campus, campus lighting, and how we want to make sure that we're not illuminating the sky. We're not going beyond the sidewalks
keeping
we need
dark
to cover.
Skies, yeah.
Yep. There's some of those things that you automatically apply for campuses. And then the most recent ones are new development. So you can do set up an entire community around and do LEED certify the community.
Wow.
So that's the entire infrastructure. And then you do the individual buildings on top of it. It's really taking off, and it's really exciting to see.
So community, you could see probably in a large community that is a business, and also in what, an apartment complex or housing development?
A large apartment complex,
that's
a
so
housing
cool.
development, a subdivision, the way that they want to put them together.
That's great. Wouldn't you love to live in a LEED certified community?
That would be so nice.
Great.
That would be really cool.
Yeah, wow. It would be great.
I can't, with at least solar panels or wind and all sorts of different.
And the neat thing about LEED is it has pushed designers and constructors to really change the way we do things. When we first started LEED on campus with Morrill Hall, one of the things it deals with was low and no VOC paints. When we first started, you could only get paint from one manufacturer, and it was $75 a gallon for a low no VOC paint. Now you can get it at, Walmart and Lowe's and
yes.
Home Depot. You can get it everywhere. It's really changed the way people start thinking about their environment at home. You know, the new car smell, you kind of in a sick way love that new car smell because you have a new
right.
car. Yeah, that's formaldehyde. It's not really good for you.
It's not good stuff. The new Barbie dolls I loved as a child, probably not the best for me either, right?
No.
That plastic smell.
But it's really changed the way we bring things home. We start thinking about recycling at home, about what we're bringing into the house, repurposing, upcycling, downcycling. You know, it really, because it's become more and more mainstream and it's not just sort of out there on the fringe, it's just part of everyday life now. We're seeing students come into campus who expect recycling programs because they've been doing it at home and they've been doing it in their community.
Interesting.
And LEED has pushed us on campus because LEED requires recycling of paper and cardboard and metals and glass. Mm-hmm. And so it's pushed us to expand what had initially just been a white paper recycling program on campus.
To everything.
To now everything. And now we have single stream.
Well, quickly tell us about your very first LEED certification process. What was that like to get? Iowa State's an institution. It's hard to get things to happen sometimes. Tell us about that project.
Morrill Hall was the first project, and it was actually very exciting. Morrill Hall was initially built in 1890, finished in 1891. It had been around forever. They constructed the building originally for $28,000. Added electricity for almost $350. Now,
wow.
Electricity back...
$28,000 building.
$28,000. You can't build a house for $28,000.
You can't build a garage for $28,000.
I was going to say, exactly.
But electricity back then would have been, you know, a large room the size of what is the chapel or any of the large meeting rooms on campus would have been light bulb on a string, would have been electricity in the building.
Mm-hmm.
It was well used, well loved, and abused over the years. So by the late 90s, about 97, the building really had been emptied out, and the intent of the president at that time was to tear the building down because it was in horrible, horrible shape.
That was Martin Jiskey.
Under Dr. Jiskey. When Dr. Joffre came in 2001, he was approached by a number of alumni that pushed him to save this building. It had been empty and vacant for about 5 years. And so in 2002, he announced a challenge to raise money for it. And this is the first building that we have done that was fully funded by alumni donations. We've got hundreds of people who donated for this building, down to students who gave $100 to $250 as they pledged toward it. And so we went in, and it was great because we had a series of programs in the building, the textiles in clothing collection, as well as the art in state building, that because of the collections in the museum space we're going to be putting in the building, needed a low-no VOC building. Because one of the worst things you can do for textiles and for paper, especially historical documents, is, bad air, high VOC things, as well as cleaning product and other things.
Right.
So it pushed. That was our first green cleaning program on campus.
That really kicked that off on campus,
That was the
too.
Only building that was green cleaning because we couldn't use standard chemicals in there.
Huh.
And we went in, and when we started the building, it was scary because you walked into the building. It had been locked and pretty much checked once a week.
5 years vacant.
Years vacant. Things get cold. Things get scary. There was one room, because the windows never really shut, that Virginia Creeper had come up the side of the building, in through the windows, had covered the walls, the floors, and the ceiling. So I first go in there in August of 2005, and the wind is kind of blowing, so all of the Virginia creeper leaves are moving. You've got noises because there are ground squirrels in the building. And it was sort of like a Jumanji-like room.
I love that description that you described.
You just sit there.
Perfectly visualize it.
Oh, it's very creepy. But we tore everything. We gutted the building. We cleaned it out. We opened back up the windows, which had been, in many cases, blocked up. And thanks to, the inventions of James Carrier, air conditioning, in what had been the original museum for the building on the third floor. It's this beautiful double-height space with big arched windows. The entire top of the room, everything above 8 feet, had been covered because we stuck air handling units and ductwork up there. Well, we open it all back up. You take advantage of the daylight. You put very carefully designed and energy efficient equipment in the building because you're dealing with museum collections. They have to stay within a 5-degree temperature range 24/7, 365. You can vary humidity about 2 percentage humidity points over a period of time. So it's very energy intensive. But we were able to design a building that was about 33% more efficient than building code required for that building code.
That's
and
exciting.
We're left with really a building that was almost better than it was originally. We've opened up all the windows. The building when it was built was very simple. All of the trim was pine. And even in the chapel space, which was up on the second floor, is now a large classroom, it looked like everything was oak and highly detailed, and you got in and you took it out and you realized it was all pine, and the doors and the trim and everything in there had been hand-painted to look like stained oak.
Wow.
Wow, interesting.
And we'd done bad things to the building over the years. The stair, it had one stair in it. It had rise to run, so the length of the stair and the height of the step varied from landing to landing all four floors up the building, from the basement to the third floor.
Huh.
So interesting. What a diverse project to take on for the first one.
It was only the seventh project certified in the state of Iowa at the point we got it done. It was the first at any of the region's institutions, and it was the first building that was on the National Register that was addressed by LEED. And we did some great things. We put back a roof that looks like the original slate roof that was on the building.
It was a slate roof.
Originally, there was a slate roof. It was taken off in 1914 because the weight of the slate was collapsing the roof. The structure under the roof was very poorly put together. What's up there now is recycled rubber.
That's not slate.
It's not slate. It looks like
slate.
It
yeah.
looks like slate from the ground. It is 100% recycled rubber. If you get up close and look at it, you can look at every slate and realize it's the same stamp. But from the ground, it looks like slate. Mm-hmm. And it's got a 50-year warranty. We were looking at ways to save money when we did initially bid the project. It came in high. The option was to go back to the shingled roof that had been up there before. It was about a $25,000 savings, and it was great because a representative from the president's office at that time sat there and went, okay, we're looking at saving $25,000 on something that has a warranty of 20 years. We are going to spend $25,000 just in scaffolding to replace the roof on this building.
Right.
We're just going to spend it, do the 50-year, the slate roof, the faux slate roof. And so you look at that. Again, it's that triple bottom
life
line.
Life cycle cost.
It's the
analysis.
Life cycle cost.
Absolutely.
Of where it comes in, what's best. It gives a wonderful presence now on Central Campus that it's done.
It's a fantastic space. I mean, it is a space that, gosh, you go to, you can have this really wonderful solitude sort of environment. It's a beautiful, beautiful space from that, you know, that, that sort of feel-good standpoint.
Right.
Wonderful space going from the Jumanji, you know, effect to this wonderful space that so many people spend a lot of time in. Beautiful sculpture garden around the area, very centrally located on campus. It's fantastic.
What types of changes did this project create at Iowa State to – So you were successful with one project.
We were successful with one project. The president, President Joffe, was very excited about what this did because it was really starting to mesh in with the direction that Iowa State was trying to take with sustainability, both agricultural and engineering, and pushing sustainability as our a major focus of us as a land-grant institution. And so he made the decision at that point with a lot of input from facilities in the University Architect's Office that – we will make all of our new buildings and our major remodelings now will be LEED Gold. A year later, that was in 2007.
Oh, this happened pretty quickly. One building and you jumped to LEED Gold. Okay.
One building and we jumped to LEED Gold. And then the regions came along with their sustainability goals the next year in 2008 and said that all new buildings will be that would a minimum of LEED Silver. For us, gold was very easy to do because we have a set of design standards we've established for the institution.
Mm-hmm.
We have millions of square footage of space that we retain, hundreds of buildings that we do. So we kind of know what works, what doesn't work. And so we've set these design standards, and because of them, we can say we are going to build buildings that are going to last 50 to 100 years. That really leads in well with what LEED wants to do, because they want you to build a building that is going to last. And so just by using our standards and what we wanted in energy and some of the other things we do, LEED Gold was very achievable for us. And
we
brought it on, and it brought on green cleaning to campus. There's
green cleaning in all buildings now?
That's green cleaning in all buildings. It is the standard. With LEED, because we couldn't bring those chemicals into the building, so we started using microfiber cloths and safe cleaning materials. The custodians, sometimes it takes a little more work in some areas, but you're not exposing people to those chemicals. There's no possibility with the cleaning materials we use now that somebody could accidentally mix two things together where you used to have something with bleach and something with ammonia in the same carts. If you actually mix that together, you start to create a very toxic acid.
Right.
Now we can't do that. You can't hurt people with the things that we're using to clean. And so it just makes a nicer work environment for the people who have to handle it every day.
That's great. You mentioned the design standards that Iowa State mm-hmm. has as sort of a foundation, and that's a really unique thing that Iowa State does that is not common among universities around the country. A lot of universities, as I understand it, Carrie, and you can definitely clarify more, but when I've talked to other universities, they've sort of said, we want to make a project LEED certified, and then they sort of set the team loose to start from ground zero, which can be really challenging and not really give you the building that you want at the end of the project. And
right.
with us having those foundation standards that get us to LEED Gold, then you can add in some other unique qualities, but you've got that nice, solid foundation.
Yep,
and that's just something that really, really to applaud our team at Iowa State.
Thank you. Can people take tours of Mora Hall?
Yes,
they
can.
How do you get to see this beautiful building?
It's a campus building, and because of the museum space in there, the building is open. The museums are open in the afternoon, so you can wander through any time you want. People can contact me at facilities if they want to do group
Carrie
tours.
Carrie Dixon, you want to give them your phone number? Give it to them twice.
Yes, it's Carrie Dixon. My phone number is 294-8028, or you can contact me via email at kdixon.
Pretty easy.
Very easy. At iastate.edu.
Yep.
If you want to do larger group events, I'll take tours through. But you can also do some self-directed tours. We've got information on the building on our building's website. So you can find some of the history about the building at moral.iastate.edu, or you can go to our facilities website, which is fpnm.iastate.edu.
Lots of information. You can just search the Iowa State website.
You can, and then you pick on building information. You can pick any of our buildings on campus. And on our LEED buildings, there'll be a pamphlet that you can get to at that point that you can do a self-guided LEED tour through the building to look at things.
Okay.
But it also, for the people who are interested, at that point, you can go and look at any one of our buildings and look at the energy consumption on a monthly basis. So if you've ever...
Very interesting to compare them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're very open about that, because a lot of times we deal with faculty and students who use this for research and for classes. So you can go look at what the energy, what the electric consumption on Hawk Hall was, or the library, or Vet Med, and compare it to
the residence hall
or the residence. Mm-hmm. But look at like what their energy consumption is versus what your home energy bill was. And be scared.
It's very interesting.
This is your host, Jim Werbel. I've been talking with Mary Rankin, who is our sustainability expert, more or less, on both City and Iowa State, as well as Carrie Dixon, who is in charge of, as an architect at Iowa State, talking about LEED certification. Any final comments?
Well, I wondered, Carrie, if you could just give us a quick summary of the number of LEED projects now that we have. We started with Morrill. Where are we now at Iowa State?
Currently, we have 11 certified buildings. We have three of them in the process of certification, and we have six more that are under design or construction right now. Right now, we are leading any of the other entities in the state, both Regents institutions. The only really corporate organization that has more than we do right now is Come and Go.
And they've got a lot more stores.
Thank you. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host, Jim Werbel. I started the show by talking to Alex Fafer and had an interesting discussion about Billy Sunday Road and the history there. I also talked to Mike Easton, the regional and global ministry leader at Cornerstone Church, about some of their outreach activities. Finally, I talked with Mary Rankin and Carrie Dixon about the LEED building design at ISU and Morrill Hall in particular. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and at 7 p.m. today. You can listen to today's Local Talk show or any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you'll also find information about our guests, along with the relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm. Local Talk has been engineered by Jonah DeGeese today. Thank you, Jonah. And our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Riches from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team, contact us at 292-2878. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember your participation as a listener and your generous contributions. Yes, generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
This is KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. We are Community Radio, the heart of Iowa.
Hello and welcome to the Movie Soundtrack Show on KHOI's Morning Masterpieces program. I'm Tom Beal, and today we're featuring the soundtrack from the 1996 musical drama Evita. The film adaptation of Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber's Broadway hit starred Madonna as the famous, or perhaps I should say infamous, Argentine leader Eva Perón. Leaders of a certain age will still remember this extraordinary young woman who came out of a little village